The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
This week on Science for the People, we're looking at how worldwide environmental challenges interact with our increasingly global economy. Hello and welcome to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and my first guest is Amy Larkin, an award-winning entrepreneur and environmental activist who has 30 years of experience as a volunteer and staff person at Greenpeace. As Solutions Director of Greenpeace in 2010, she led the Consumer Goods Forum, which is a consortium of 400 multinationals, to eliminate super greenhouse gas HFCs from the new refrigeration equipment starting in 2015. She's also the author of Environmental Debt, The Hidden Costs of a Changing Global Economy. Welcome, Amy.
Hello, Desiree. Good morning.
Now, the premise of your book is that businesses and, to a certain extent, government have a role to play in environmental stewardship. And, of course, we all know that. But your angle is specifically from a cost-benefit perspective, correct?
It is largely from a cost-benefit perspective, but it is also from a risk assessment. Right now, if you are a company making anything that uses agriculture, you are scared to death because extreme weather is altering the agricultural stability of the planet. So in addition to having shortages of things you need, you cannot predict your profit and loss. So in the very short term, if wheat or cotton or soy is going to cost 50 or 100% more because of extreme weather in places that you never really think of, you are going to look bad for the financial industry. Wall Street analysts are going to look at you and go, why did you not hit your marks? Well, there was extreme flooding in Pakistan, or there were fires in the Ukraine, so my cotton or my wheat are unavailable or hugely expensive. That's why. So companies are way ahead of government in realizing the threat.
Now, that's not something that we usually consider, is that companies are ahead of the curve in this, because one of the big concerns to most companies is that better environmental policies internally usually cost them money.
Before I started working with these companies 10 years ago, I am certainly of their sternest critics, and I would have thought that would be exactly the case. And as I learned, there is a schism in the business community. I've been in meetings where marquee American companies step forward and say to big fossil fuel companies, you cannot talk about carbon security and national security separately. They are the same thing. And honestly, had I not been in those rooms, I wouldn't have believed it. But now it's for everyone to see. There are companies everywhere stepping up and trying to protect both their own long-term interests as well as the world's stability.
But again, this is not all companies.
So what? No. Absolutely not all companies.
So what are the reasons that business might be hesitant to make their policies and practices more environmentally friendly?
Well, number one, it's more expensive. I also think there is a reflex, like a knee-jerk reflex within many, many businesses that regulation is bad. It is just in the DNA of the government relations people and the lobbyists. You know, there are few companies that began by imagining, actually, we are for this climate bill. We are for a cost on carbon. And what has happened is, as the leadership companies, the companies you might expect to be leaders in this arena, like Nike or Apple or Johnson & Johnson, or Mars, or Coca-Cola, or Unilever, companies that have high brand issues and also are led by strong environmental advocates. Those companies then make it easier for others to follow. Now, I am not saying that all those companies are environmentally clean, green, and okay. Obviously, Apple and Foxconn only came to change its ways when it was exposed. So I am not living in a fantasy land, and I hope your listeners are not going to call in and say, what is she talking about defending these corporations? I am absolutely applauding these companies when they do fantastic work. And to their chagrin, I am absolutely noting when I think they don't.
Now, what you're saying in your book is that even though many businesses consider themselves successful, and they do look that way on paper, they're using incomplete metrics to measure their performances. So let's start with, what are they measuring by now? What do they measure success by?
It's a very limited view of costs and revenues. Right now, accounting does not include financially, contractually, environmentally, or ethically the environmental impact of most of what is used, produced, manufactured, transported, delivered, and disposed of by corporations and we, the consumers. So these coffee pots, which are the fastest growing piece of the coffee industry, being put forth into the world by, quote, socially responsible companies. So Starbucks and Illy and Nestle and Green Mountain Coffee, for God's sake, are pushing a ridiculously wasteful, high energy, high impact, the most ridiculous product. There's nothing good to say about it. First of all, they are way more expensive. They use packaging that includes aluminum and plastic. They're very hard to recycle. So you have packaging you didn't have before, mining and plastic and carbon emissions for transport you didn't have before, dyes that are used on the packaging. Each of these companies should be charged for the extra waste. And if there were a price on carbon, they would be charged for the extra transport that they are incurring. They would be charged for the pollution from the aluminum and the plastic caused in the packaging, as well as the dyes. And it is not only the companies. We as consumers buy $5 t-shirts that do not account for the cost of the labor, the water, the manufacturing. Every day when we talk about the pollution in China, about a quarter of that pollution comes from producing goods for North America. China has stated that 3.5% of its GDP is caused by environmental damage. I would bet it's more. KPMG measured the environmental damage costs from the 3,000 largest public companies in 2008. The best they could come up with was that it was $2.15 trillion. And Puma went down to the micro level, and in 2010, they created what they called an environmental profit and loss statement, and they measured water use, greenhouse gas, land use, other air pollution, and waste. And what did they find? If they included those costs in their normal profit and loss statements, it would have cost them 72% of their annual profit. That is bad accounting practices.
This is Science for the People, and I'm here with Amy Larkin, author of Environmental Debt, The Hidden Costs of a Changing Global Economy. Now, this idea that the accounting of companies has to change, that's a large part of your book. Can you tell us some more about what you'd like to see there?
I would like to see incentives built into accounting so that environmental costs are integrated into basic accounting. Right now, when people talk about public budgets, they do not connect it with the private budgets in a way that shows how the costs are socialized. In the United States, it is estimated that air pollution causes more people to die than does tobacco. The healthcare costs alone of air pollution are killing on public budgets for healthcare. For educational costs, the extra costs of mercury and developmental disabilities have educational costs. The rescue workers, the time lost for people having to stay home with kids or staying home ill themselves. We don't count those costs, but they are public costs that we all pay. The cost of water filtration system, the cost of dead zones in places where pesticides and fertilizers from agricultural runoff destroy huge swaths of the world's oceans, of the world's seas. And we do not know if and when that's going to tip over to make even bigger problems. Those dead zones cost other businesses a huge amount of money. They cost regions a huge amount of money, and they cost federal budgets huge amounts of money.
All of the environmental impacts that you're talking about, how do you tie that directly to companies, first of all? And then even if you could, how would you calculate that on a balance sheet? Like, practically, how would that look?
Well, with great difficulty, and thank you to Puma for starting the process of creating the first environmental profit and loss statement. And they did that in concert with PricewaterhouseCoopers and TrueCost, which is a small boutique firm that does exactly what it says. It tries to calculate the true cost of business. And they went four levels down the supply chain. And after the Puma did this for 2010, they gathered a bunch of experts and said, how can we make this better and clearer and more accurate? And they are taking a lessons learned approach. And I'm very happy to say, not only are they doing it for Puma again, the parent company of Puma, which is Kering, which is, I think it's the largest luxury brands company in the world. Stella McCartney, Gucci, Yves Saint Laurent, other companies like that. They are all doing an environmental profit and loss statement across the whole company. Other companies, other big multinationals are preparing similar things. It is very, very imperfect science now. But in balance sheets right now, huge pieces of a company's valuation is its, quote, goodwill. I think that people have a fantasy that accounting is clear-cut right now. It is not. What you say is your cost, what you try to pass off as somebody else's cost, how you work your taxes, it is all based on rules that are a bit, they're just skewed. You know, why the government pays for flood insurance or crop insurance for people that build on floodplains and farmers that exacerbate their possibility of being flooded makes no sense. Or, you know, in places that should not be growing what they're growing. If you are a big agricultural company and you create broccoli or almonds in places where there isn't a lot of water, and then there's a drought, why should the government bail you out? Well, because you have good lobbyists. And now I think this entire view is under review. And there are numerous global business organizations working on this, trying to change the rules of accounting. It is a long haul. Last week I have a piece that was in The Guardian. I actually believe that there is one transformational lever which could be deployed before we figure out the whole system. And that is to provide accelerated depreciation for green infrastructure investments. If a company like PepsiCo builds a state-of-the-art facility that costs them a lot of money, and does this magnificent job of providing near net zero wastewater and energy. Now, they've done this, and they did this because it was part of their passion, their mission, their purpose, and they are a branding is a huge piece of their business. But other companies, which are normal vanilla companies that are not necessarily as brand sensitive and do not have serious environmental advocates within the company, might not do that. So incentivize them to do it. So it's the only way you can do business so that, again, the biggest polluter does not make the biggest profit.
Again, that's the responsibility of the government, and that's one of the things that that you bring up in your book, is that if companies want to remain competitive, they're really relying on the government to put in place these regulations so that everybody is working on the same playing field.
Exactly, which is why there are surprising numbers of these leadership companies in particular, the high brand value, the Nike and IKEA, companies that have a certain relationship with their customers, Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, Google, Apple, you tarnish their brands, they're not happy. It is a big piece of their value. And in addition, they are led by people currently that are actively looking to change government policy. And I have a section in my book for the company, which is probably the most progressive multinational in the world, which is Unilever. And the company made a commitment in 2010 that it will double its revenue and halve its environmental footprint by 2020, within a decade. And that is one hell of a commitment. And as they began that journey, they discovered that where there is good regulation, so where waste is limited for consumers and for businesses, it is much easier to reach their goals. Where waste is not really accounted for properly, where government doesn't charge for it, where water regulations and carbon regulations are minimal, it is going to be very, very hard for them to achieve their goals because all the other bigger polluters will make a bigger profit. And here's where the extraordinary piece comes in. So what did Unilever do? It started a global advocacy office to try to bring in good, strong regulation to help level the playing field. To me, that is the idea of what a company should do.
You're listening to Science for the People, and my guest is Amy Larkin, author of Environmental Debt: The Hidden Costs of a Changing Global Economy. So I am potentially being cynical, but aren't a lot of these companies only making changes because it serves them well from a public relations perspective?
Probably. Why do I care if they're doing it?
Well, do we have any idea how much negative PR around environmental concerns actually affects a company's bottom line?
I think that it's both the negative PR, but actually the bigger issue is Coca-Cola had a plant shut down in India because farmers said it was using too much water. So it then embarked on an amazing water initiative over the next 10 years. That's self-interest because they don't have water, they don't have a business. People do all kinds of things for all kinds of reasons. But for me, good self-interest is one of the best reasons. Why would PepsiCo build a near net zero water plant in Arizona? Because there's no water. that's a really good reason. Why are Google, the IT companies that have these huge server farms, which need huge amount of electricity, why are they investing billions and billions of dollars into renewable energy projects? Well, I don't really know the answer. Some of it is, I'm sure, environmentally inclined people. But hey, those servers go down, their business goes out of the way. They need to own safer kinds of energy. I don't call renewable energy renewable anymore. I call it safe energy. It is less likely to be financially hit. It is less likely to be resource hit. It is safer on all grounds. It is less likely to give you interruption of service based on big, bad environmental events, whether it be coal ash spills or oil spills. So for me, I am thrilled that they are leading the way for environmentally safe, financially safe energy. I don't care why. You know, really, if it's because their daughter told them to do it or their granddaughter, great. If it's because Greenpeace or another environmental activist shamed them into doing it, fine. If it's because they see the bottom line is going to be better, who cares? They're doing it. You always, as an environmental activist, I do not walk into a company and state, hey, you should do this because I think it's a great idea. I will say, I want to suggest you do this because here are your risks financially, contractually, environmentally, public relations-wise. You have big risk. And so this is why you should do this. Now, they will often then say, and so, of course, it will also be good for the environment. Yes, it will.
Well, I'm wondering if that's actually sort of these kind of tactics go arm in arm. Greenpeace makes, some other environmental company makes a huge embarrassing scene, but you also offer a tangible solution that allows a company to save face.
You know, I cannot tell you the number of times I was in meetings with corporations. And as the solutions director, we were sort of walking in as the good cops. And at the end of a meeting, very, very often, a corporate executive would say, you know, I never expected to have this meeting with a Greenpeace. I just didn't expect this. And I would always say, I am only here because my colleagues jumped on your roof or parachuted into your plant. But once you're there, you can do amazing things.
Well, what do you say to people, especially maybe within Greenpeace, that think that these building of long-term relationships and these, you know, 15 to 30-year plans, that they aren't quick enough, more radical solutions are required?
Well, when I was working with Greenpeace as solutions director, we only brought in radical solutions. We never came in with anything incremental. There are many other environmental organizations that do incremental work, and it's perfectly fine, but it was certainly not the role of Greenpeace to do that. I think that the environmental crisis is so dire that, for me, I think you have to work on transformative work now that will hit 1, 2, 5, 10% of climate change, that will alter the course of the degradation to the world's water systems, et cetera, that will start protecting topsoil en masse. Those are the kinds of changes that I hope to make with corporations.
I'm not quite sure what you say in those boardrooms to get people on board, but you're obviously having some success. So, but what's interesting is you have actually, you've wanted to open up this dialogue to more businesses and individuals and government as well. And you've set up a website to promote that kind of conversation?
I am working now with Resolve, which is a Washington, D.C.-based organization. And we are just now beginning a project on energy where we are looking to bring people who normally don't talk to each other to try to break some of the intractable log jams on removing some of the obstacles to huge, fast deployment of safe energy. And then on my website, environmentaldebt.net, I include recent pieces that I have written and recent pieces of work that I have done regarding large change with business.
What kind of response are you getting?
I'm in a funny position because quite a bit of the work I'm doing now I can't talk about, but I can tell your listeners that companies, not in 1 million years, what I have expected some of the companies that I have now engaged with to be wanting to pursue a radical change strategy. The companies you would least expect are looking at radical turnarounds. And I don't know if you're familiar with what Walmart did about 10 years ago. It began, a little less than 10 years ago, began a strategy of transforming its supply chain. Now, it still sells a bunch of stuff, cheaply made, unaccounted for, et cetera, et cetera. So this is not a plug for Walmart. But their environmental initiative has transformed much of the world's supply chains for its goods for the better. A long, long, long way to go. But if they started from zero, in 8 years or so, they've moved to, I don't know, 30, which for a company that size is no little feat.
Well, and Walmart is one of the things, one of the pieces in your book that I found so fascinating, because I can definitely see how having them on board is ideal, because they do play such a large role and they can put such pressure on their own suppliers. But, you know, getting back to the PR issue, does sort of this greenwashing, I guess you could say, this positive press on environmental issues, that just distracts away from a company's records on other issues? And for example, with Walmart, it's they're doing great on environment, but incredibly badly on workers' rights.
Well, I don't think they're doing, I wouldn't say they're doing great on environment.
Okay.
I think they have a huge way to go. I would not call them a great environmental company under any circumstances. But they had the courage to say, the direction we are going in is cataclysmic, and we're turning. Now, there's a bunch of stories about why they did that, one of which is certainly that their CEO and chairman took trips to Costa Rica and the Arctic and were flabbergasted by the issues of environmental degradation and climate change. I believe that. And they then basically turned the ship. Long, long, long way to go. But I have to say, it is not only Walmart that has that long way to go. We are accustomed to buying cheap stuff that is throwaway. We do not treat our stuff as if it is precious. We don't pay for it as if it's precious. And we ignore the fact that it comes from real sources, from nature, is produced by real factories where people who are probably indentured servants work. Every time we read about the air pollution and water pollution in China, it's our t-shirts, our computers that are a huge reason for making them. So until we as consumers and governments, as people who control what is considered profit, what is considered costs, and what is considered loss and liability, until that happens, it's a very hard road for Walmart, Target, IKEA, and others to produce goods in a way that fits into how the world's economy works. And this goes back to the initial premise of my book. This environmental debt, which is real money and real risk, is being currently borne by mostly governments and other businesses and individuals. So if I choose to buy organic produce and organic meat or don't eat meat, I am not responsible for those dead zones. But I'm paying for them. I'm paying for them in the insurance premiums. I'm paying for them in the unemployment for the people who are losing jobs in the tourism industry there. I'm paying for it, and I don't want to. I would like everybody to have to pay for the real cost of what we use. So we as consumers are a part of the problem and a part of the solution.
Amy, you are doing fascinating work, and thanks for being here.
It is my total pleasure, Desiree. Thank you.
And we've linked to Amy Larkin, author of Environmental Debt, The Hidden Costs of a Changing Global Economy, on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. We'll be right back with journalist Ken Silverstein to talk about climate change and the competing pressures it creates for the insurance and energy industries.
Science
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
This is Science for the People, and I'm Desiree Schell. My guest is Ken Silverstein. With a background in economics and political affairs, Ken has spent 2 decades covering corporate and public policy. He's worked as a beat reporter, a Washington, D.C. bureau chief, and an editor. He's now the editor-in-chief of BreakBulk.com and BreakBulk magazine, which focuses on international trade and transportation and which is heavily geared to the coverage of global energy issues. He's also a columnist for Forbes and the Christian Science Monitor. Good to have you here, Ken.
Thank you, Desiree. I'm glad to be here.
Now, you wrote a very interesting article for Forbes on business and the insurance industry and their quite different perspectives on climate change. Can you walk us through what your piece calls the widening rift between energy and insurance companies over climate change?
Well, I mean, it's a great debate, actually. Insurance companies are concerned that global warming may cause it to pay out excessive claims. And insurance companies have a lot of political clout. They have deep pockets and they make political contributions and they are able to get their positions heard by U.S. lawmakers. This type of political power is now run headfirst into an equally strong political force. Members of the energy sector, you know, whose products, according to many scientists, may be contributing to global warming. So you've got one industry that says, you know, global warming will affect its exposure and its ultimate payouts, versus another that is producing electricity, producing the fuels that cars run on, which wants to minimize the regulations placed on it.
In terms of those damages, how much money are we talking about here?
You know, we're talking billions and billions of dollars in potential damages. It's important to note that there are credible scientists who agree that global warming is a function of man-made energy production, that is the burning of coal and fossil fuels, who say that the phenomena of more severe weather is not a function of burning fossil fuels, that actually the amount of extreme weather and the ferocity of extreme weather is not any greater now than what it's been in the past. You know, I'm not a scientist, and I don't want to pretend to be a scientist, but that's the essence of the debate, which is if the burning of fossil fuels leads to more extreme weather patterns that insurance companies are going to ultimately be responsible for in terms of payouts, and if they go head-to-head against the fossil fuel industry, I mean, this is going to be a classic political battle. This is not environmentalist versus a well-heeled industry. This is two well-heeled industries that would be at odds with one another.
And that's what's so interesting about it, because regardless of where you stand on climate science, this is about money. So can you talk about Farmers Insurance Company and the suit that they filed against the city of Chicago?
On a very high level, Farmers is saying that the city of Chicago has not taken the necessary precautionary measures to guard against the effects of extreme weather. Therefore, it has put the insurance company at an unnecessary risk. On the scheme of things, the amount of money that's being called for is small. However, the point raised in the suit is one that could have far-reaching implications. That is, cities have an obligation to insulate themselves from damages from extreme weather that not only protects the city and its businesses, but it also protects the insurance companies that would be insuring them and be responsible for some of the damages.
What would the city have had to do to be able to say that they did try to mitigate those damages?
In the case of Chicago, you know, it's right there on Lake Michigan. And I'm sure that if there were severe weather, that water would wash ashore and go in the streets and maybe in businesses. Are there guards against making sure that doesn't happen or to mitigate the possibility of it? I can't give you specifics because I don't live in Chicago. But as a homeowner, for example, he or she is responsible for shoveling the sidewalks and making sure people don't slip when they come up to their door. It's a reasonable thing to ask of a homeowner, and it's one for which they would be held to account or could be sued if there were some type of mishap. So as an insurance company is asking the same of a city.
So in addition to the Farmers Insurance Company suit, what are we seeing from other insurers?
Well, that's a great question, and it gets to which entity has more political force, the insurance or the fossil fuels. And at this point, you would have to, at least in terms of the global warming debate, you would have to argue that it's the fossil fuel industry because it's more directly impacted by these potential regulations than is the insurance industry, which hasn't come together as a whole to take on this issue. There are certain insurance companies that have taken on this issue, but not the industry as a whole.
Right.
So until they all come on board, it's not going to be this battle royale. It's building up to that, and it will ultimately be a function of whether or not there is a definitive link between more hurricanes and global warming or more extreme weather and global warming. If these extreme events occur with great rapidity and cause great damages, then I think the insurers would band together and come together as a political force.
That's interesting. So we might see something like insurance companies lobbying the government for climate change policy?
Well, some of them are doing it now, but they're not doing it. They're not making these great PR moves. You know, they're not holding seminars on Capitol Hill and inviting lawmakers. It's more of groups like Standard & Poor's, which examine the credit ratings of major companies, for example. You know, they're saying that global warming, that risk tied to global warming should be part of one's due diligence when they look at whether or not to invest in or to loan money to a corporation.
Now, one thing that you haven't mentioned that you did in your piece is that there was also a report issued saying that the credit ratings of sovereign countries could be affected by global warming.
Again, that was Standard & Poor's, which made that assertion that, you know, whole countries could be affected by, at least in terms of credit ratings, in terms of their global warming risk. And the ones that would be most affected would be those in low-lying areas, which are typically emerging nations, which can least afford the fallout from it. What it's saying is that it really divides the haves and the have-nots. And if you look at that even further, that's particularly interesting because, you know, one of the arguments that the fossil fuel industry makes is that coal is the great equalizer. You know, that is that America got its share, okay, and now that it got its share, it wants to prevent, you know, the emerging nations such as India and China from getting theirs.
Right.
Coal is abundant, it's cheap, and it can industrialize a nation just as it has the United States and Canada. But what Standard & Poor's says is that it would also put them at greater risk. That is, if these events caused environmental damages that would add up, that it would in fact take them the other direction.
See, this is all so fascinating to me because the insurance industry and business have typically been allies, have they not?
Well, I don't know that you would call them allies in the sense that, you know, they crusade for the same causes because they're two separate industries. Mm. But it's accurate to say that they're both big business and they both have a general philosophy, which is that the free market works best.
So what's this issue doing to that relationship then?
It is in the beginnings and it's trending toward becoming a more conflicting relationship. It would appear that the trend is that more insurers are going to be asking the government to take steps to mitigate the effects of global warming. In terms of the United States government or the Canadian government, they are being asked to do something more larger, which is to regulate carbon dioxide emissions from power plants.
Let's do some speculation here. What might the impact on business be?
I'll assume you're asking specifically about coal. Coal has been responsible, as we have discussed, for helping to industrialize the United States of America and building its economy into a global powerhouse. But the power plants that helped do that are aging. Many of them are 50 years or older, and they have to be replaced. And the people in the coal industry say that, you know, coal can continue to do that. It is cheap and abundant, and therefore it should be the great economic equalizer. Well, the thing that's not mentioned but is mentioned by its opponents is that coal, its environmental costs are externalized. That it is, that when the coal industry extracts and burns, okay, there's a cost of doing that, but there's also a health cost associated with the harmful emissions that are released, and that those costs are picked up by others, such as health insurers, or in the case of those who are insured by government programs, by the government and taxpayers. So one of the things the Obama administration wants to do is to put some of those external costs back on the coal industry so that the true cost of burning coal is reflected in its price.
Ken, thanks very much for being here.
Absolutely.
You'll find links to Ken Silverstein and BreakBulk.com on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. We'll be back with Arjun Hoekstra, professor of water management at the University of Twente, to talk about water scarcity in business right after this.
On the next episode of Science for the People, we're learning how deadly and delightful our planet and its ecosystem can be. We're joined by biologist Dan Riskin, co-host of Discovery Canada's Daily Planet, to talk about his book, Mother Nature is Trying to Kill You, a lively tour through the dark side of the natural world. And we'll talk to astronomer and author Phil Plate about Science Getaways, his new company that offers educational vacation experiences for science lovers. That's next week on Science for the People, on your local radio station, or online at scienceforthepeople.ca.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Arjun Y. Hoekstra. And Arjun is chair of the Department of Water Engineering and Management at the University of Twente in the Netherlands. He's the author of a recent Scientific American piece about how water scarcity is challenging business. Great to have you here, Arjun.
Yes, thank you.
Now, you recently wrote an article on the water scarcity challenges that business is facing.
Yes, I'm doing research on this topic already for a long time. And what we see is that water scarcity traditionally is a topic on the desk of governments that are responsible for water management. But nowadays, the reports are increasing from business that actually their business performance is being influenced by water scarcities in their operations in different places, or sometimes not in their operations, but in their supply chain.
Well, let's maybe start out with a definition. What does freshwater scarcity mean?
Yeah, freshwater scarcity is not like drought. Drought is like a natural phenomenon. If there's not a lot of water, or if there's a period with not a lot of water, you have drought. But water scarcity is the mismatch between the water demand on the one hand and the water availability on the other hand. So even in places where it's kind of still some abundance of water, water can be scarce if the use of the water becomes very intensive. Now, water scarcity looks like a river that is drying up because the water is being taken by agriculture, for instance, to irrigate crops. Or it's a groundwater level that is declining from year to year because water is being pumped for agriculture again or industries. Or it's like lakes drying up, like the Aral Lake is a famous example in Central Asia. So you can physically see water scarcity in the field.
And it also includes things like heavily polluted waters, right?
Yes, if you like, water scarcity is not only about shortage of water, but also about pollution of water.
And also we see that in the increasing costs of supply and treatment.
And not only the costs of supply, but also supplies that are just stopping. For an electricity power plant, for instance, you need water for cooling. But if there is not enough water for cooling, then it's not the cost that is problematic, but just the absolute absence of the water.
Now, where do we see this happening?
In the US, for instance, in the Midwest, in California. You see it in all of North and Southern Africa, Middle East, Southern Europe, Australia, many parts of China and India, so Central America, so all over the world.
And why exactly is it becoming scarce?
Now, it's not so much because climate change, although climate change may affect scarcity in the future, but it's mostly because of the increasing demand for water, number of people increasing, and our diets are changing towards more meat-intensive consumption patterns, and meat has a larger water and land demand per calorie than crop products.
Well, now you said this isn't climate change that caused this, but climate change does contribute to water scarcity.
Water scarcity is the amount of water you need divided over what you have. So if you get less, and this is what many climate predictions say, particularly in the dry periods of the year, then of course scarcity will increase because of the climate change.
So now how does this affect business?
Yeah, so the risk for business is, there are different sorts. First of all, there is this risk of not having water supplies or having problems of water supply in the supply chain. But on the other hand, there is the risk of new governmental regulations. And it's not so clear what kind of shape those regulations will get. Will it be increased pricing, or will those regulations mean that there are quota for water use? So this is quite uncertain, and this means a risk for business. Probably most important is also the reputational risk for business, because consumers, they realize that many products they consume on a daily basis, they come from water-scarce areas where water is being overexploited already today. And a brand will not like consumers to know that in fact their product is already today not sustainable.
Well, now this is going to affect companies in each country differently, correct? Depending on whether they're primarily exporters or importers?
Yeah, what you see is that currently there are a few regions in the world that are in fact using water a lot for export products. And this is these are Northern America, the US and Canada, but also Southern America, Brazil and Argentina, and Australia, and also China and India to some extent. So those are kind of the suppliers of water for the world, not in physical sense, because they don't supply water to other parts of the world, but they supply water-intensive commodities to other regions of the world. And if in those regions water becomes scarcer, those regions will have more difficulty in exporting those commodities. And this holds, in fact, for all the countries I just mentioned, particularly the US and Australia, which suffer from water scarcity increasingly more. So they will not continue to be the exporters of those water-intensive commodities. Same for China and India. So the other regions of the world will need to produce increasingly the water-intensive products for themselves.
So just because a company operates in a water-abundant region, they can still be vulnerable to water scarcity then?
Yeah, because most companies, their supply chain is worldwide. So a lot of many components in their supply chain probably are in water scarce regions elsewhere.
This is Science for the People, and I'm talking to Arjun Hoekstra about his Scientific American piece on water scarcity challenges to business. Okay, now, businesses are actually starting to identify this, all of this, as a potential problem, and they're assessing their water risk. How are they doing that?
Now, they look at where are their different factories based, and also they explore the supply chain and identify which elements in the supply chain run the risk of water shortage. What they do is they look at the water footprint of their product, the full water footprint. It means the water consumption and water pollution in both operations and supply chain. And they identify the risk elements by looking in which places the water footprint is in fact already today unsustainable or in the near future. So they may need to shift to other production regions in the supply chain. They may shift even factories. But more importantly, they probably need to invest in both operations and supply chain to make water use more efficient, so that with the same water in the world, we can produce more. So the water scarcity problem is reduced.
Now, you've said that companies should strive towards zero water footprint in industrial operations. Can you explain that?
Yes, companies generally do need water, which is not a problem, but the water footprint measures what we call the consumptive water use and the pollution, and these two elements can be zero. Consumptive water use means that the water is evaporating and cannot be reused again in the catchment by other users. So the consumptive use can be reduced to zero by having closed systems. And water pollution is also not necessary. It can also be reduced to zero. So a zero water footprint means no consumptive water use and no pollution at factory level.
And is that across the supply chain then?
That's not across the supply chain. This is mostly for industrial operations, because in agriculture you cannot reduce the water footprint to zero. You will always have evaporation from the field, although you can reduce that often by a factor 2. You cannot reduce it to zero, obviously.
You've also suggested greater transparency on water consumption and pollution. And that's something that that a lot of companies are talking about in a lot of different areas. So how would that look?
No, that's kind of still an open question to everyone, including all companies and me. Yeah, we are thinking in a number of directions, and companies also try a number of different things, including, for instance, a labeling to products. A label can show the extent to which the water footprint of the products is sustainable, yes or no. There's still a lot of discussion about how such a label should look like. Preferably it's included, integrated into already existing environmental and fair trade labels. But apart from product labeling, for instance, the Alliance for Water Stewardship globally tries to establish a water stewardship certification scheme for business, so that companies can certify their factories. So this is kind of still an open question.
Now, even with all of these changes, you still don't think that that would be enough, correct?
Now, it's clear that if you leave it to companies alone, there will not be a solution, because what we see is some global visible companies, they are taking action, but there are so many other companies that don't take action. Managing the water risk is something else than real good water stewardship. So you can, for instance, reduce the risk by going to another place where the water is not yet overexploited. But this does not help the solution, of course. So what you need is companies invest, and there needs to be incentive for that, and the incentive needs to be provided by government in the form of regulations that really drive companies towards taking those investments. Now, what governments need to do is establish water footprint caps per river basin that, that put a cap to the total amount of water consumption and pollution per basin, given the limited availability of water and limited assimilation capacity within the basin. So then, this total cap sets a maximum to the footprint within that basin, and water footprint permits provided to companies should not go beyond the total cap for a basin. So this is a kind of regulation that prevents over-exploitation of water resources in a basin. But I think also government needs to do something in terms of water pricing. Generally, the price of water is far below the real cost and doesn't reflect scarcity. So prices will need to go up and need to be set by government, because it's kind of a public resource, there's not a market for it. So there needs to be a price set somehow.
Well, I assume that there are people or organizations that are lobbying for exactly those kind of regulations?
Not so much yet.
Really?
So it's a bit surprising that water footprint caps do not already exist. There's something existing like that in Australia, but not yet really well set, because it's a cap that refers to a maximum amount of surface water use. That means the water from the rivers, but that means that farmers are now moving to groundwater. So that's kind of, you need, of course, a regulation that is capturing all. You would expect also some sort of water footprint benchmarks per product already, so that people know what is the maximum reasonable water use for a product. But those kind of things, they don't exist yet in this field. And the whole problem of water scarcity comes on the political agenda only recently, and becomes visible for ordinary consumers also only recently.
You yourself say in the article that corporate engagement on water could be seen as a cynical attempt by business to extend control over the resource, or just an effort to maintain a favorable brand image.
What you see is they call it water grabbing or land grabbing. Companies making sure that they buy lands, for instance in Africa, that they then own. So they don't own the land only, but also the water resource attached to the land. So they, in this way, they secure their supplies. So if you take the cynical look, then the positive attempts by business doesn't look that positive. But it's not really my personal point of view to be so cynical, but it's a way that some people look at it.
So then, since you've been doing so much research in this area, what are your projections? What do you see happening in the future?
What we already see is that water is increasing on the political agendas, also on, for instance, the agenda of the World Economic Forum. So I think that the efforts to manage water resources properly will increase at all levels, from the local to the global, and also in different sectors, in the private and the public sector. But I think that at the same time, even though this is all very positive, we can expect similar sort of problems as that we have seen in the field of climate change, where also a lot of efforts are being taken, but where in the end, the amount of greenhouse gases that are emitted to the atmosphere, these amounts are increasing still. And this is what is probably to be expected also in the field of water. There will be a lot of efforts to reduce water scarcity, but it's hard to believe that actually the coming decade water scarcity will decline because of those efforts.
Well, then when will it decline? Will it decline?
No, it will decline in the longer term, I guess, yeah. Because the investments needed and the time needed for real change. So it takes quite some time, and I think maybe 20, 30, 40 years until the population has stabilized. We have come to understand that our diet shouldn't contain so much animal products, until we have solved the demand for biofuels through other forms of energy, like wind and solar power. So the optimism is there, but for the longer term.
Arjun, thanks very much for being here.
You're welcome.
And we've linked to Arjun Hoekstra and his piece on water scarcity on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. While you're there, click the links to connect with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Science for the People.